six, five, six, seven, eight.
Hello and welcome to Study Hub, the podcast that aims to give you the tips and tricks to help you do your best in your Leaving Cert. My name is Maura Fay and I'm your host for RTE Study Hub. Today we are kicking off with one of the most creative papers on the Leaving Cert. It's English Paper 2, the one with Shakespeare and poetry.
Who, in the lusty stealth of nature, take more composition and fierce quality than doth within a dull, stale, tired bed go to creating a whole tribe of fops? Between asleep and wake. Well then, legitimate Edgar, I must have your land.
Academy Award winning actor Riz Ahmed there performing King Lear. And Study Hub has Clodagh Havel from the Institute of Education to guide us through English Paper 2. Clodagh, let's start with the format, the number of sections, the marks and the duration of the exam.
Sure, Maura. Okay, well, the paper is quite long, 3 hours 20, so you need to have your stamina ready. Chronologically, it starts with a single text. Now, most students in the country will be doing the Shakespearean option, which is King Lear. But if anyone's listening that's not doing King Lear as a single text, don't worry, there are 7 others that a teacher might choose. And if that's the case, then you start with that. But every single honours Leaving Cert student must do Shakespeare somewhere, and they might put it into the comparative. So there'll be 2 questions on the Shakespeare tragedy. One often kind of like a character-based question, another then is a theme language-based question. Moving on from that, you have the comparative question. And this year, still left over, a hangover, if you will, from COVID, we have all 3 modes coming up on the paper, which is very exciting because it actually means you can go in with 1 mode and be guaranteed a question. So that's really pleasant. And the other hangover comes into poetry, the prescribed poetry. There are 8 poets on the course. 5 will come up on the paper as opposed to 4. And then, of course, we finish with the unseen poem, which is the very last 20 marker, which must be done in order to get your H1. A lot of people are exhausted by the time they come to the unseen, but get over the line.
OK, so let's start off with the single text. What can students expect to be asked here and how should they go about approaching it?
OK, well, there'll be 2 questions on your single test and text, and they'll have a different emphasis. Now, this is very loose, OK, because the one thing I'll say about the single text, the clue is in the title. It is single. They expect you to know it inside out. So therefore, the questions will be broader. OK, but if I was to narrow it down with experience, I suppose one will be a character based question. Now, that can come under a good and evil idea, like good characters, bad characters, not necessarily write all you know about King Lear or whatever. And then the second question will usually be some sort of language question. It could be imagery. It could be, kind of how imagery interacts with other like soliloquies or whatever. But my advice to you here is don't look at them exclusively. Mm. Go in ready to do both because one will blend into the other. One will enhance the other. So when I hear students going, oh, I'm just focusing on language, it makes me nervous. Okay. Because you could actually use your language information to write a very good character question.
Okay. So then, can you explain to me the different modes? Like, what are modes and how do they relate to section 2?
Okay, so that comes into the comparative. It's like anything. What a mode is a way of comparing something. So there are 48 texts in the comparative question, and your teacher will take 1 novel, 1 play, 1 film. And the idea behind the question is really a great, interesting question, actually. You compare the texts using these modes. So the first one is a cultural context. So it's the unique world of the text. So for instance, say I'm doing Never Let Me Go. That is a dystopian, futuristic novel. Compare that to Scythe, say John B. Keane, which is 1950s North Kerry. And then you'd compare that to Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig, 2002 Sacramento, America. And you look at the culture of that and you just see how the culture that these characters live in, how they affect their decisions and how they go about their lives. It's a really interesting question. Running parallel with that then is something called general vision and viewpoint. And that's about perspective. It's about how the creator of the piece wants you to feel. So optimistic, pessimistic, laughter, scared, whatever, and how they trace that through their texts. And, you know, sometimes it's like, who does it better? Did Gerwig do it better than Friel, for instance, or John B. Keen or Iziguro or anything like that? So general vision and viewpoint is about perspective. And then finally, theme and issue is infinite. So any theme at all. So, I mean, you can talk power, patriarchy, love, violence, peace, and you trace the connection between all three texts. And ultimately, the best way to engage in a comparative question is to personally engage. That's where the marks are, to actually see how each writer affects you. That's the H1.
Okay. Because you mentioned there, like, infinite. There is an infinite amount of ways that you could compare two texts. So what is it the examiner is looking for you to demonstrate? Because it just feels a little overwhelming.
Of course. And it's about depth of understanding. And I mean, it's literally, you know, I tell my students, it doesn't matter what theme you have. You can have freedom, you can have power, you can have love. It doesn't matter. It's to show your understanding of how the writer, director or playwright deals with that. And invariably, one of them will appeal to you more. So it's not to be overwhelmed by it. Trace it slowly and then ask yourself, how do I feel about that theme? And more importantly, where are the key moments where that theme is best developed? So in the comparative question, if you had about 9 key moments in total on that theme, you're over the line.
When it comes to selecting questions and reading through the paper, what approach do students take here?
I am a firm believer in a gut reaction. Okay. I really am. and I'll stick to it because most students will be able to answer most questions. Yeah. All right. So it actually comes down to something. Oh, I like that. Or if there's a word that you're not 1,000% sure of, see if there is an alternative. You need to absolutely commit. My best piece of advice is that commit to the question, because halfway through you will feel a little tired. You might look at an alternative question and go, oh gosh, I could do that. Well, that's just your exhausted mind looking at the freshness of a new question. So it is a gut reaction. If you respond going, oh, there's Yeats, if that feels good, and you have Yeats, you know, known real, commit to that. It's very, very difficult for me to say what the real clue is. But I do feel that inside, if you have prepared for this exam, your gut will kick in.
OK, so you've picked a question. You're vibing with it.
Yes.
How do I structure my answer?
OK, so, you know, it's a real case of say what you're going to say, say it, and say what you said. English is about structure. The H1 student will structure beautifully. It will take the examiner through very, very easily from the introduction to the conclusion. I'm a firm believer in topic sentences. Every paragraph has to have one single developed point. Nothing else. There's no fillers, right? Mm-hmm. And you lead with a topic sentence, which tells me what that paragraph is going to be about. And then you do that and never ever start an English question without a mind map or some sort of guidance running beside you that you think, there's my thesis. You look at the question, you go, what is my argument? What am I going to say here? Am I going to agree with this? Am I going to disagree with it? Or am I going to sit on the fence? And when you commit to your thesis, you trace that through in and about 800 to 1200 words. For most of us, that'll be about 4 A4 pages. And then you just commit with the topic sentence with about 5-6 paragraphs and you've got a structure.
Everybody's bane of, you know, existence is learning quotes. OK, is there a magic number of quotes I should learn?
Oh, you know, it really is the case. There's two ways of learning quotes. You can learn them all off and make sure they go into that question, you know.
Shoehorn
yeah,
them in.
Oh, I'm putting those in no matter what. Or, you know, that's a H3. A H1, you will strategize your quotes. If I was to say 3 quotes per paragraph, I'd say there's a lot of teachers around the country now saying, no, you need more. But if you had 3 well-developed quotes per paragraph. What is a quote? Quote is evidence. You know what I mean? That's what it is. And it backs up your thesis. So you don't want the quotes to become your answer. Mm-hmm. All right. The quotes are to support your answer. So if you had about 3 in each paragraph, and if you have 5 paragraphs, I'm going to plump for 15 quotes per answer. Now, I know that sounds a lot to some, and maybe others might have 30. Just be careful with the quoting. And I know it's like your porridge, not too many, not too few. Just enough. Okay.
Okay, you've a handy mnemonic for here for people. What is PCLM?
Well, it's not my mnemonic. It's actually the department's. Every English is so subjective, right? It's that I can read a short story, think it's the best thing I've ever read. You might read it and go, not so much. So therefore, you have to standardize it in English. And the PCLM is the standardized marking system. P is for purpose. Literally, are you answering the question asked? Closely followed by that, you have clarity. Have you done that in every single paragraph? Language is then how you express yourself. It's often the difference, really, between a H1 and a H2. A H2 student's going to know their stuff and they're going to have the P and the C very good. The language, it's the salt and pepper, it's the little spice, it's the way you say it. And then mechanics is your spelling, your grammar, and so on. So it works 30%, 30%, 30%, 10%. So every single question, whether it's a 100 marker or whether it's a 10 marker, actually has a PCLM marking system. My advice really today, know it. Know how it works so that you can apply it to every question.
Okay, let's move on to poetry. The big money question, what poets are going to come up?
Oh, no. Well, this year, actually, it's very simple because there are 5 poets coming up. And would you believe there are 4 women and 4 men? Happy days. So, gun to my head again, you could actually go in just knowing the women, or you could actually go in just knowing the men,
okay,
and you are guaranteed a question. But it's easier now to say what I don't think is going to come up because of the 5 out of 8. I think Tracy K. Smith is a banker, by the way. I think she's a banker, and I think Hopkins and Boland are bankers. Who I'm less expecting, wait, you see the 3 of them will come up, who I'm not really seeing Platt, I'm not really seeing Elliot, and I'm not really seeing Mahan. And if they do show up, I apologise in anticipation.
I never liked Platt. She was far too depressing. So, OK, the unseen poetry question. Talk to me about that, because that's, you're seeing this poem for the first time and you're not fully sure what it's about. How do I approach it?
Okay, so my tip there is very, very simple. You have studied 48 other poems that in the last 2 years. You have studied, on average, 6 poems per poet. So with that, you bring that knowledge to the unseen. It is merely a comprehension, the unseen poem, which you've done in paper 1 anyway. So what you're doing is you bring your poetic knowledge to that new poem that you've never seen. So stop thinking, oh my God, I've never seen it before, and look for about 5 techniques. Spot the personification, spot the metaphor, spot the ambiguous title, spot the run-on line, spot whatever it is that you've done in all the other poems. And through that, you will eventually get in the region of 200 words out of that. So it's called synesthesia. It's the imagery, right? The imagery of the eyes, the ears, whatever. You can always find out. No one's expecting you to get into the shoes of that poet and know exactly what that was about. But what you can do is personally engage with what is there for 20 minutes in some form of poetic answer, and you'll be absolutely fine.
Fantastic. Just lastly and briefly, how should people use their time in this exam?
Okay, now this is very rough, but it's 3 hours 20. You have 3 big questions and 1 small one. So I'm going to go 1 hour each question and 20 minutes. Now, technically, it's a little adjusted because the comparative is actually 70 and the prescribed is 50. But if you went in expecting 1 question per hour with a 20 minute unseen, don't leave until it's all done.
Okay, thank you so much for
that,
Clodagh. Okay, let's turn our attention to chemistry.
And what's the universe made of? I'm so glad you asked.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium. Everybody! And iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium.
That is Sheldon Cooper there from The Big Bang Theory, going through the periodic table of elements. Joining us to go through chemistry is Enda O'Dowd, teacher with the Institute of Education. Enda, how many questions are on this paper and how many do students have to answer?
So, chemistry paper, there are 11 questions on, and the students have to answer any 8 questions of those 11. Now, it's important for students to know that because that's changed since COVID. So pre-COVID, there's a section A and a section B on the exam. There's 3 questions in section A and 8 questions in section B, and that makes up the 11. Pre-COVID, they had to answer 2 from section A, but now that's gone. So they answer any 8 questions on the paper from the 11. So sometimes when students are checking past exam papers and they still see the instructions tell them to answer 2 from section A, and then they're still wondering, is that still the case? So it's not the case. Any 8 questions from the 11 provided.
So you have a nice variety of questions there, a nice range of options. What should students be focusing on now revising?
So the big section, and they won't thank me for this, but the big section is organic chemistry. Organic chemistry is between 40 to 50% of the entire exam. So I say they won't thank me because it is a lot, but my big advice would be to start now. Organic chemistry is question 2. There's an organic experiment question 2. It's in parts of question 4. Question 6 is on oil refining and fuels, which is more organic chemistry. Question 8 is on reactions in organic chemistry. And then usually question 10 or question 11 has another organic part. With organic chemistry, you have to get the basics right. So there are 8 organic families. Students have to be familiar with how to name those families, the different members in the families, and how to draw the structures. Now, everything comes from there. If you can't name or draw the structures of the families, you're going to struggle with all organic chemistry. You have to start with the basics, and then it all filters into the rest of the topics.
Okay, so that's probably starting off your revision then. Talk to me about reactions. Question 8 is always about reactions, is that correct?
Question 8 is always about reactions. There can be some other things in there as well, but there definitely will be reactions. So there are 8 organic reactions as well. There's 8 families, and there's also 8 reactions, how those families intermingle or react with each other. Question 8 always has some of those reactions, not all of them, but some of them. There is usually something called a reaction scheme shown to you, where students have to, they're shown reactions, they have to identify which reaction it is and maybe the reagents necessary. There's also something that is quite common called a mechanism, where students have to actually be able to talk through the steps of how a particular reaction works. Once again, it comes back to you will not be able to do that reactions question if you don't know the basic families in the first place. You have to know that, and then it progresses to the reactions.
Okay, so we know in English you have to write a lot. In chemistry it's a little bit different. You say that students need to be careful with their language. Explain that to me.
Yeah, they need to be very careful. You don't necessarily have to write too much, but words matter in chemistry. Words really, really matter. So a common place students would lose marks is they would kind of answer definitions and answer questions in their own words, and what they write is not necessarily wrong, and they would think they've answered it correctly. But if you compare what they've written to the marking scheme has got keywords and key language literally in bold that they have to use. So if they're writing some other word that they think is the equivalent of it, they might think it's the equivalent word, but words matter. It's not. So for example, concentration and volume are not the same word. Atom and electron are not the same word. They mean different things, but to students, not always. They think that they're just chemistry words and they're interchangeable, but they're very much not. So language really matters.
So just like you've learned quotes in English off by heart, you've learned definitions in chemistry off by heart.
Exactly. And they'll have their book or their notes to study, but what's also essential to study is the marking schemes from previous years, because they need to use that same language for their marks.
How should students use their time in this exam?
So it's a 3-hour exam, and they have to answer 8 questions. Now, I mean, 8 questions is the minimum. My recommendation to my students is always try and answer a 9th question or even a 10th. So if they were answering 9 questions, then that would you'd talk about an average of 20 minutes per question. Now, some questions might take them a little bit longer, but other questions, they will work back that time. Question 4, for example, you could do in 10 minutes. So you'd work back the time. So you're talking about an average of 20 minutes. I would also advise against trying to answer all 11 questions on the paper. Sometimes I get where when I hear students coming out of an exam and they're delighted that, oh, I answered all 11 questions, and I kind of go, oh, maybe I'm afraid you didn't put enough detail into what you're answering. So I would say 8 is the minimum, 9 is good, and 10 is good. And that's what I would say.
Are there any bankers or any predictions that you have as to what's going to come up on the exam?
No bankers, and I would be very careful with predictions in general, because I've seen students go into exams and their whole world falling apart when whatever titration they wanted, they expected to come up, is not on the paper.
You're so mean, but I know that you're
I have to be cautious because, what you can do, you can of course look at previous years, and you can look at the things that haven't come up in the most years. So for example, in question 1, which students will be familiar with, is a titration. There's 10 titrations and one appears every year. The ones that haven't come up in the longest time is one is the iron tablet titration. That has not appeared since 2009. And the other one is a titration to standardised sodium thiosulfate, which hasn't been up since 2015. So every other titration has been up in the meantime, some twice. But those two are the ones in the longest time that haven't come up. So if you're going to my head, I would be telling students to really, really concentrate on those two.
And question three is always on experiment.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Question three is on question. So question one is a titration. Mm-hmm. Question two is an organic experiment. And then question three is a non or inorganic experiment. And again, there's a list of those experiments. And again, going back to predictions, the one that hasn't come up in the longest time, there's one to measure the relative molecular mass of a volatile liquid. It's actually quite a nice experiment for students that have studied it and are familiar with it. That, again, is the one that hasn't appeared in the longest time. There's also two experiments in the water chapter that have not come up in question three in a long time. So again, those two, or there's three, again, would be the most likely ones.
Okay. Full disclosure here, I did chemistry for the Leaving Cert. I got a D2 in the mocks. I ended up getting an A2 in the actual exam. So yeah. If students did badly in the exam, like I did, like you do say this is an exam where students can make progress between now and June.
For sure. Students make amazing progress between the mocks and the real exam. And the difference really boils down to pre-mocks, before the mocks, there's not that much exam paper practice. And it's a big difference. So once the mocks are done and you get your result, at least it gives you a baseline of where you're at. And then past paper practice is absolutely essential, especially the last number of years. So the last 5-6 years, they've started to add, I mean, this chemistry course has been going on a long time, since 2002. So they've kind of exhausted the material and they're trying to find different ways of asking the same material. Now, the only way to handle that and get used to it is to go to the past papers. So especially last 5-6 years, a lot of past paper practice and checking marking schemes to make sure you're using the right language. But they can make huge progress between mocks and the real exam, for sure.
I always feel that doing past papers is a lot easier than just reading text and trying to
memorize. Yeah, exactly. So an actual physical practice of questions as opposed to reading a book. So in chemistry, a lot of things you need to understand visually. So there's a lot of drawing of molecules and a lot of drawing of structures to actually visually understand it. And then it makes the learning much easier. So reading from a textbook is not the way to go. So a lot of past paper practice and a lot of physically writing down things.
Okay. Lastly, on chemistry, yeah. And you say that when it comes to picking what questions to do, students should focus on their strengths. So some might be a little bit more maths oriented, or some might be a little bit more just better at learning information off. Tell me about that.
Yeah, exactly. So again, when it comes down to picking your 8 questions from your 11, again, some of the students, they get flustered because they don't know what questions to pick. But exactly, it comes down to that. Some students are very good at learning some stuff off by heart, and there are questions that tailor to that. So organic chemistry, if you're good at learning stuff off by heart, you'll be quite good at organic chemistry. Atomic chemistry is the same. There's a chapter on water is the same, whereas other students are more maths minded. And those students should definitely be looking at questions like pH and indicators, acids and bases, stoichiometry. Volumetric analysis has got lots of maths in it. So it depends on where the student's strengths lie in their choice of questions. They should answer their best questions first. So they don't have to answer questions in sequence. They can start with question 11 if they want. Answer their best questions first and get those done. And then they can start look at the questions that they're maybe not so comfortable with.
Okay, great advice there from Ed O'Dowd, Institute of Education chemistry teacher. Lastly, we have home economics.
Look, we all know home ec is a joke, no offense. It's just like everyone takes his class to get an A, and I'm sorry, and I'm not putting down your profession, but it's just the way I feel. I don't want to sit here all by myself, no offense, and I just think that I don't ever need to cook tiramisu. When am I going to need to cook tiramisu? Am I going to be a chef? No.
I need to know how to cook tiramisu because it's my favourite dessert. So I strongly disagree with Jonah Hill there in Superbad. He would have had a bit of a surprise if he tried home economics for the Leaving Cert. You have to know about biology, nutrition, sociology, textiles, composition of food, home management and consumer technology, plus a lot more. So it's a broad subject, but here to take us through it is Sandra Cleary from Grinds 360. Home economics and scientific and social, to give it its full title. Tell me about the format of the paper, Sandra.
There are three sections to the paper. The first section is section A. We have 14 short questions and we have to answer 10. What a lot of students mightn't know is that the first 9 are guaranteed to be on the food studies syllabus, and the remaining 5 come from the what we call the home management section. Things like finance, household technology, consumer studies, those areas, textiles. And you should always play to your strengths. So some students, in fact, the majority majority of students preferred the food studies. So you might answer 9 from there and maybe 1 from the home management. Or you can answer 5 home management and 5 from food studies. But it's a part of the paper that is very poorly answered. Very poorly answered. And it's worth 15% of your overall grade. A lot of students compare short questions with home economics to those of, say, a biology paper or a business paper, and they're completely different. Because normally when you see short questions, you think short answers. And where students would put something down, it would be correct, but it wouldn't be enough. So students should realise that every short question is worth 6 marks, which is 1.5% of your home economics grade, which is a lot. And they're worth 6 marks each. But what I even find as a teacher very off-putting, since the papers have started to be corrected or online, they no longer put number 6 beside the question. So I'm always there saying to them, bring in your pencil and break up the question. And generally they are like 2-2-2-3-3. You know, that's repeated. And you might get one question where it's a general statement worth 6, break that into 3 parts. But the general rule to get full marks, 2 marks, 2 subpoints, 3 marks, 3 subpoints. So just say you're asked, what is an essential amino acid? You write down an amino acid that the body cannot make, and you get 1. It's correct, but you have to give an example.
Okay.
Then we move on, and I would spend 2 minutes each on these, and I would answer them last, not first. A lot of students might decide to answer them first. Some would say, oh, my teacher said it will get me in the mood. Anyone out there who has studied home economics for the last 2 years, there is nothing on this planet that will actually get you in the mood for that exam. What I would say is I would answer them last, because you don't have to worry about structure. You don't have to worry about layout. It's right like a maniac, literally. And if your timing hasn't gone exactly to plan, you know, it's easier fill in the gaps, shall we say, rather than trying to worry about a structure.
OK, so are you suggesting then students start at section B or section C? Or?
Section B. We have a compulsory section B, then the second part of the paper. We have 1 compulsory question, so every student has to answer it. It's worth 80 marks, 20% of your overall grade. Now, what a lot of people forget about is virtually half of those 80 marks is unseen material. So the first part of question 1 and section B, the compulsory question, you have to analyse a table, a chart, a histogram. It's usually from a food survey. It could be from Bord Bia, it could be from the FSAI, the National Teen Survey. And they give you information, and they're not in any textbooks. So you must remember that when you see that table, chart, whatever it happens to be, every other students sitting down, this is their first time seeing that as well. And there's a specific way of going about that, and that is you read the table, the histogram. You must understand what it's about, because there's a tendency, remember, it's day 1 of the exam, students are very stressed and they think they should be writing straight away. So you have to take a breath, read it. Some students might get it in a minute, others might take 2 or 3 minutes, but do not write anything down until you understand that table. When you read the question, there's usually 2 key terms like comment, elaborate, comment, suggest reasons. And I would always say to students, answer in a table format, approximately a page and a half, but certainly no more than 2 pages. Do a rough work page. The 2 keywords that you highlight, comment and elaborate, they should be your vertical columns. And then the columns going across, they'll either specify 4 or 5, or you look at how many bars in the histogram, and you have, if there's 4 bars, 4 across. And it's 2 things would be, you have to give the information on the table. You must refer to it in your answer. You will lose marks. So if it's percentages, you must refer to those in your answer. If it's numbers, you must refer to them in your answer. And something that a lot of students don't know either is you have to refer to ranking. So just say hypothetically, I got a pie chart stating from Bord Bia, stating all of the exports, very topical at the moment, tariffs and whatever else. But anyway, well, just say it's looking good at the moment, our exports, and say, I don't know, dairy is the big one, and then your meat, etc. You're meant to say dairy is the most popular export, and then you give the percentage. Meat is the second most important export, and you give the percentage. And that could get you 8 out of 10, or 8 out of 20, even 10 out of 20, just by stating those facts.
Yeah, it seems like nearly too easy. It's like they can't be looking for that.
But that's the thing. Yeah. It is that easy. But because it's not designated in textbooks, students are afraid of it. And for many students, the first time they saw those tables was actually at their mock paper. So I would say, don't go back 10 years, go back maybe the last 5, because you want to keep it topical, and just take out your marker, look at the table, do I understand it, find the two keywords, get a piece of rough work paper and do out the table. But you do need to have practice. Now, there's a nutrient the whole world and his mother is obsessed with. What nutrient is coming up? And usually you can kind of bring it down to 2.
Okay. But give me the 2.
Oh, that I had. Well, all I'd say is it's wide open this year.
Okay.
But if I were pushed,
I'm pushing you.
Okay. I would keep an eye on protein. Hasn't been asked since 2020. Lipids, we're looking for lipids for quite a while. That was 2018. But also be wary of the sneaky ones. Calcium, 2019. What linked with osteoporosis. And then you have vitamin A, not asked since 2012. Vitamin B12 since 2009. So you actually need to cover all of those. And then the last part of question 1, section B, is what I call the dodgy 20. Well, I don't actually call it the dodgy 20. A student of mine many years ago said, Sandra, that's very dodgy looking. And I said, so it got the name, but yeah. it's worth 20 marks. It's 5% of the exam. And again, it's all about practice. And usually these reflect what's going on in the world outside. So, for example, in 2023, how can people live healthily on a budget? Because the cost of inflation, the cost of food went up. I think you want to be watching things like food waste would be a big one. You know, think of topics that are very relevant at the moment. So that's your question, and you should spend about 40 minutes on that question. For the other part of section B, you've got 450 markers, and this is where you can kind of take a breath. You've got great choice here.
Okay.
Because even though I can't tell you, I don't know what the topics are, we do know that definite areas come up, which a lot of students would ask. They're not aware that every year question 2 is guaranteed to be on food. Now, when I say food, it could be a food group, meat, eggs, fish, cheese, or it could be a diet. Like, for example, you'd have to keep an eye. Coronary heart disease hasn't been asked since 2007. We know obesity hasn't been asked since 2013. I'm not giving tips here. And then you go on. Question 3, you have to keep a really close eye there, because yeast, like Enda was saying, his course, chemistry, is coming to the end. Ours is coming to the end. 2 years' time, we're going to have a new syllabus. So they've exhausted everything except yeast has never, ever been asked. Okay. And also, I keep saying there about reflection of, because home economics is a living subject. We cannot live 1 hour of our day without home economics. And bacteria and food poisoning. You might recall that case of botulism in France during the World Cup.
A
big thing. So you'd want to watch the two of those there for that question. Processed food, food additives. I did say I wasn't giving any tips there.
I don't think you're being exactly truthful there. Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
So they would be there for question 3. And then question 4 is guaranteed to be on what's called the home management section. Budgeting hasn't been asked since 2015. Savings accounts. Again, reflection of what's going on in society. Yeah. Housing. I mean, every day we wake up, we hear about the problem with housing. So trends in housing developments not asked since 2012. Neither have they asked since that year about local authority schemes, you know, for people who are struggling maybe to get on the housing ladder. So things like learning about the HAP payment would be one, or the tenant purchase scheme. So question four, also watch the fridge there, or consumer research from Consumer Studies.
Okay. The last section of the paper, section C, what is that about? Because there's a lot of marks here as well.
Well, we're back to pre-COVID paper, basically, except for one thing, and that's here. And section C is usually what we describe as the, I suppose, the prepared work, your chosen specialised topic. Half the country generally do elective one or elective three. Elective one would be home design and elective three social studies. In the middle, we have textiles. Very few do that. But I would personally be saying to students, focus on the addition we got after COVID, which is question four core. And why I would emphasise that is because it is exactly like the questions you get on section B, food studies. So topics I gave there for the 50 markers in section B, they potentially can come up here in question four, the core. Why would you take on a whole section of another area when you can just say, well, if I learn my topics for the shorts and for section B, I can use all of that information that I've learned and I'll answer question four, the core. And it's the first thing I would do when I go into the exam, and that is, I know we were all dying to get into that paper. Who wouldn't want to be diving into home economics on a Wednesday afternoon, the first day of your leaving? But the first thing I would do is go straight to section C and get a pen and cross out the three you are not going to do, because it's human nature. When you'd get to section C, and you know, you are panicked that day, there's no denying that. So at least when you do get to section C, you will only focus on your particular page that you've chosen.
Lastly, Sandra, you've advice for people saying that they should build a folder with five sections. Explain to me those five sections.
Well, first of all, you have learn in sections, and then you can learn topical areas. There's no predictions, but you certainly, I've done out a 6-week intensive revision plan, which students can access. And basically, obviously, you need to cover everything for the H1, but there are certain topics that you need to absolutely make sure that they're top of your list. So with regard to that, what did you say?
No, I just said the five sections, how should they be structured?
Oh, yeah. So the nutrients would be one. I see I ramble too much.
Oh,
God love
good
those students out there. So yeah. Nutrients would be one. Food groups would be another. Then you would have, we call, say, the dietary section. And then you have the, what we call it, the home management section. Mm-hmm. Put five of them in that folder, which would be the household technology, the consumer studies, the textiles and the finance section there. And then finally, you have your sociology for question five, the core. Watch marriage and the family. Keep an eye on those.
I love these tips. Thank you so much for that. Sandra Cleary there from Grinds 360. And she mentioned there she's extra study and revision material online. Just look up RTE Learn Senior Cycle and you'll find that information. That's it for this week's Study Hub. My thanks again to Sandra, Clodagh and Enda. Next is our final week of Study Hub. We'll be looking at Irish Paper 2, History and Physics. And as always, if you want to get in touch with the podcast or have any questions you want answered, drop us an email, studyhub@rte.ie. See you next week.